This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right, by Atul Gawande. Read for you by John Bedford Lloyd. Introduction. I was chatting with a medical school friend of mine who is now a general surgeon in San Francisco. We were trading war stories, as surgeons are apt to do. One of John's was about a guy who came in on Halloween night with a stab wound. He had been at a costume party. He got into an altercation, and now here he was. He was stable, breathing normally, not in pain, just drunk and babbling to the trauma team. They cut off his clothes with shears and looked him over from head to toe, front and back. He was of moderate size, about 200 pounds, most of the excess around his middle. That was where they found the stab wound, a neat 2-inch red slit in his belly, pouting open like a fish mouth. A thin mustard-yellow strip of omental fat tongued out of it. Fat from inside his abdomen, not the pale yellow superficial fat that lies beneath the skin. They'd need to take him to the operating room, check to make sure the bowel wasn't injured, and sew up the little gap. No big deal, John said. If it were a bad injury, they'd need to crash into the operating room, stretcher flying, nurses racing to get the surgical equipment set up, the anesthesiologists skipping their detailed review of the medical records. But this was not a bad injury. They had time, they determined. He lay waiting on his stretcher in the stucco-walled trauma bay while the OR was readied. Then a nurse noticed he'd stopped babbling. His heart rate had skyrocketed. His eyes were rolling back in his head. He didn't respond when she shook him. She called for help, and the members of the trauma team swarmed back into the room. His blood pressure was barely detectable. They stuck a tube down his airway and pushed air into his lungs, poured fluid and emergency release blood into him. Still, they couldn't get his pressure up. So now they were crashing into the operating room, stretcher flying, nurses racing to get the surgical equipment set up, the anesthesiologists skipping their review of the records, a resident splashing a whole bottle of betadine antiseptic onto his belly, John grabbing a fat number 10 blade and slicing down through the skin of the man's abdomen in one clean, determined swipe from ribcage to pubis. Cautery. He drew the electrified metal tip of the cautery pen along the fat underneath the skin, parting it in a line from top to bottom, then through the fibrous white sheath of fascia between the abdominal muscles. He pierced his way into the abdominal cavity itself, and suddenly an ocean of blood burst out of the patient. Crap! The blood was everywhere. The assailant's knife had gone more than a foot through the man's skin, through the fat, through the muscle, past the intestine, along the left of his spinal column, and right into the aorta, the main artery from the heart. Which was crazy, John said. Another surgeon joined to help and got a fist down on the aorta, above the puncture point. That stopped the worst of the bleeding, and they began to get control of the situation. John's colleague said he hadn't seen an injury like it since Vietnam. The description was pretty close, it turned out. The other guy at the costume party, John later learned, was dressed as a soldier, with a bayonet. The patient was touch and go for a couple days, but he pulled through. John still shakes his head ruefully when he talks about the case. There are 1,000 things that can go wrong when you've got a patient with a stab wound. But everyone involved got almost every step right. The head-to-toe examination, the careful tracking of the patient's blood pressure and pulse and rate of breathing, the monitoring of his consciousness, the fluids run in by IV, the call to the blood bank to have blood ready, the placement of a urinary catheter to make sure his urine was running clear. Everything. Except no one remembered to ask the patient or the emergency medical technicians what the weapon was. Your mind doesn't think of a bayonet in San Francisco, John could only say. He told me about another patient who was undergoing an operation to remove a cancer of his stomach when his heart suddenly stopped. Identifying details were changed at John's request. John remembered looking up at the cardiac monitor and saying to the anesthesiologist, "Hey, is that asystole?" Asystole is total cessation of heart function. It looks like a flat line on the monitor, as if the monitor is not even hooked up to the patient. The anesthesiologist said, "A lead must have fallen off, because it seemed impossible to believe that the patient's heart had stopped." The man was in his late 40s and had been perfectly healthy. The tumor was found almost by chance. He had gone to see his physician about something else, a cough perhaps, and mentioned he'd been having some heartburn, too. Well, not heartburn exactly. He felt like food sometimes got stuck in his esophagus and wouldn't go down, and that gave him heartburn. The doctor ordered an imaging test that required him to swallow a milky barium drink while standing in front of an X-ray machine. And there on the images it was, a fleshy, mouse-sized mass near the top of the stomach, intermittently pressing up against the entrance like a stopper. It had been caught early. There were no signs of spread. The only known cure was surgery. In this case, a total gastrectomy, meaning removal of his entire stomach, a major 4-hour undertaking. The team members were halfway through the procedure. The cancer was out. There'd been no problems whatsoever. They were getting ready to reconstruct the patient's digestive tract when the monitor went flatline. It took them about 5 seconds to figure out that a lead had not fallen off. The anesthesiologist could feel no pulse in the patient's carotid artery. His heart had stopped. John tore the sterile drapes off the patient and started doing chest compressions, the patient's intestines bulging in and out of his open abdomen with each push. A nurse called a code blue. John paused here in telling the story and asked me to suppose I was in his situation. So now, what would you do? I tried to think it through. The asystole happened in the midst of major surgery. Therefore, massive blood loss would be at the top of my list. I would open fluids wide, I said, and look for bleeding. That's what the anesthesiologist said, too. But John had the patient's abdomen completely open. There was no bleeding, and he told the anesthesiologist so. He couldn't believe it, John said. He kept saying, "There must be massive bleeding. There must be massive bleeding." But there was none. Lack of oxygen was also a possibility. I said I'd put the oxygen at 100% and check the airway. I'd also draw blood and send it for stat laboratory tests to rule out unusual abnormalities. John said they thought of that too. The airway was fine. And as for the lab tests, they would take at least 20 minutes to get results, by which point it would be too late. Could it be a collapsed lung, a pneumothorax? There were no signs of it. They listened with a stethoscope and heard good air movement on both sides of the chest. The cause, therefore, had to be a pulmonary embolism, I said. A blood clot must have traveled to the patient's heart and plugged off his circulation. It's rare, but patients with cancer undergoing major surgery are at risk, and if it happens, there's not much that can be done. One could give a bolus of epinephrine, adrenaline, to try and jumpstart the heart, but it wouldn't likely do much good. John said that his team had come to the same conclusion. After 15 minutes of pumping up and down on the patient's chest, the line on the screen still flat as death, the situation seemed hopeless. Among those who arrived to help, however, was a senior anesthesiologist who had been in the room when the patient was being put to sleep. When he left, nothing seemed remotely off-kilter. He kept thinking to himself, "Someone must have done something wrong." He asked the anesthesiologist in the room if he had done anything different in the 15 minutes before the cardiac arrest. No. Wait. Yes. The patient had had a low potassium level on routine labs that were sent during the first part of the case, when all otherwise seemed fine, and the anesthesiologist had given him a dose of potassium to correct it. I was chagrined at having missed this. An abnormal level of potassium is a classic potential cause of a systole. It's mentioned in every textbook. I couldn't believe I overlooked it. Severely low potassium levels can stop the heart, in which case a corrective dose of potassium is the remedy. And too much potassium can stop the heart as well. That's how states execute prisoners. The senior anesthesiologist asked to see the potassium bag that had been hanging. Someone fished it out of the trash, and that was when they figured it out. The anesthesiologist had used the wrong concentration of potassium, a concentration 100 times higher than he'd intended. He had, in other words, given the patient a lethal overdose of potassium. After so much time, it wasn't clear whether the patient could be revived. It might well have been too late. But from that point on, they did everything they were supposed to do. They gave injections of insulin and glucose to lower the toxic potassium level. Knowing that the medications would take a good 15 minutes to kick in, way too long, they also gave intravenous calcium and inhaled doses of a drug called albuterol, which act more quickly. The potassium levels dropped rapidly, and the patient's heartbeat did indeed come back. The surgical team was so shaken they weren't sure they could finish the operation. They'd not only nearly killed the man, but also failed to recognize how. They did finish the procedure, though. John went out and told the family what had happened. He and the patient were lucky. The man recovered, almost as if the whole episode had never occurred. The stories surgeons tell one another are often about the shock of the unexpected, the bayonet in San Francisco, the cardiac arrest when all seemed fine, and sometimes about regret over missed possibilities. We talk about our great saves, but also about our great failures, and we all have them. They are a part of what we do. We like to think of ourselves as in control, but John's stories got me thinking about what is really in our control and what is not. In the 1970s, the philosophers Samuel Gorovitz and Alasdair MacIntyre published a short essay on the nature of human fallibility that I read during my surgical training and haven't stopped pondering since. The question they sought to answer was why we fail at what we set out to do in the world. One reason, they observed, is necessary fallibility. Some things we want to do are simply beyond our capacity. We are not omniscient or all-powerful. Even enhanced by technology, our physical and mental powers are limited. Much of the world and universe is, and will remain, outside our understanding and control. There are substantial realms, however, in which control is within our reach. We can build skyscrapers, predict snowstorms, save people from heart attacks and stab wounds. In such realms, Gorovitz and MacIntyre point out, we have just two reasons that we may nonetheless fail. The first is ignorance. We may err because science has given us only a partial understanding of the world and how it works. There are skyscrapers we do not yet know how to build, snowstorms we cannot predict, heart attacks we still haven't learned how to stop. The second type of failure the philosophers call ineptitude. Because in these instances, the knowledge exists, yet we might fail to apply it correctly. This is the skyscraper that is built wrong and collapses. The snowstorm whose signs the meteorologist just plain missed. The stab wound from a weapon the doctors forgot to ask about. Thinking about John's cases as a small sample of the difficulties we face in early 21st century medicine, I was struck by how greatly the balance of ignorance and ineptitude has shifted. For nearly all of history, people's lives have been governed primarily by ignorance. This was nowhere more clear than with the illnesses that befell us. We knew little about what caused them or what could be done to remedy them. But sometime, over the last several decades, and it is only over the last several decades, science has filled in enough knowledge to make ineptitude as much our struggle as ignorance. Consider heart attacks. Even as recently as the 1950s, we had little idea of how to prevent or treat them. We didn't know, for example, about the danger of high blood pressure, and had we been aware of it, we wouldn't have known what to do about it. The first safe medication to treat hypertension was not developed and conclusively demonstrated to work until the 1960s. We didn't know the role of cholesterol either, or genetics, or smoking, or diabetes. Furthermore, if someone had a heart attack, we had little idea of how to treat it. We'd give some morphine for the pain, perhaps some oxygen, and put the patient on strict bed rest for weeks. Patients weren't even permitted to get up and go to the bathroom for fear of stressing their damaged heart. Then everyone would pray and cross their fingers and hope the patient would make it out of the hospital to spend the rest of his or her life at home as a cardiac cripple. Today, by contrast, we have at least a dozen effective ways to reduce your likelihood of having a heart attack. For instance, controlling your blood pressure, prescribing a statin to lower cholesterol and inflammation, limiting blood sugar levels, encouraging exercise regularly, helping with smoking cessation, and if there are early signs of heart disease, getting you to a cardiologist for still further recommendations. If you should have a heart attack, we have a whole panel of effective therapies that can not only save your life, but also limit the damage to your heart. We have clot-busting drugs that can reopen your blocked coronary arteries. We have cardiac catheters that can balloon them open. We have open-heart surgery techniques that let us bypass the obstructed vessels. And in some instances, we've learned that all we really need to do is send you to bed with some oxygen, an aspirin, a statin, and blood pressure medications. In a couple days, you'll generally be ready to go home and gradually back to your usual life. But now the problem we face is ineptitude. Or maybe it's eptitude, making sure we apply the knowledge we have consistently and correctly. Just making the right treatment choice among the many options for a heart attack patient can be difficult, even for expert clinicians. Furthermore, whatever the chosen treatment, each involves abundant complexities and pitfalls. Careful studies have shown, for example, that heart attack patients undergoing cardiac balloon therapy should have it done within 90 minutes of arrival at a hospital. After that, survival falls off sharply. In practical terms, this means that within 90 minutes, medical teams must complete all their testing for every patient who turns up in an emergency room with chest pain, make a correct diagnosis and plan, discuss the decision with the patient, obtain his or her agreement to proceed, confirm there are no allergies or medical problems that have to be accounted for, ready a cath lab and team, transport the patient, and get started. What is the likelihood that all this will actually occur within 90 minutes in an average hospital? In 2006, it was less than 50%. This is not an unusual example. These kinds of failures are routine in medicine. Studies have found that at least 30% of patients with stroke receive incomplete or inappropriate care from their doctors, as do 45% of patients with asthma and 60% of patients with pneumonia. Getting the steps right is proving brutally hard, even if you know them. I have been trying for some time to understand the source of our greatest difficulties and stresses in medicine. It is not money or government or the threat of malpractice lawsuits or insurance company hassles, although they all play their role. It is the complexity that science has dropped upon us and the enormous strains we are encountering in making good on its promise. The problem is not uniquely American. I have seen it everywhere, in Europe, in Asia, in rich countries and poor. Moreover, I have found to my surprise that the challenge is not limited to medicine. Know-how and sophistication have increased remarkably across almost all our realms of endeavor, and as a result, so has our struggle to deliver on them. You see it in the frequent mistakes authorities make when hurricanes or tornadoes or other disasters hit. You see it in the 36% increase over the last 4 years in lawsuits against attorneys for legal mistakes, the most common being simple administrative errors, like missed calendar dates and clerical screw-ups, as well as errors in applying the law. You see it in flawed software design, in foreign intelligence failures, in our tottering banks. In fact, in almost any endeavor requiring mastery of complexity and of large amounts of knowledge. Such failures carry an emotional valence that seems to cloud how we think about them. Failures of ignorance we can forgive. If the knowledge of the best thing to do in a given situation does not exist, we are happy to have people simply make their best effort. But if the knowledge exists and is not applied correctly, it is difficult not to be infuriated. What do you mean half of heart attack patients don't get their treatment on time? What do you mean that 2/3 of death penalty cases are overturned because of errors? It is not for nothing that the philosophers gave these failures so unmerciful a name, ineptitude. Those on the receiving end use other words, like negligence or even heartlessness. For those who do the work, however, for those who care for the patients, practice the law, respond when need calls, the judgment feels like it ignores how extremely difficult the job is. Every day there is more and more to manage and get right and learn. And defeat under conditions of complexity occurs far more often despite great effort rather than from a lack of it. That's why the traditional solution in most professions has not been to punish failure, but instead to encourage more experience and training. There can be no disputing the importance of experience. It is not enough for a surgeon to have the textbook knowledge of how to treat trauma victims, to understand the science of penetrating wounds, the damage they cause, the different approaches to diagnosis and treatment, the importance of acting quickly. One must also grasp the clinical reality with its nuances of timing and sequence. One needs practice to achieve mastery, a body of experience before one achieves real success. And if what we are missing when we fail is individual skill, then what is needed is simply more training and practice. But what is striking about John's cases is that he is among the best-trained surgeons I know, with more than a decade on the front lines. And this is the common pattern. The capability of individuals is not proving to be our primary difficulty, whether in medicine or elsewhere. Far from it. Training in most fields is longer and more intense than ever. People spend years of 60, 70, 80-hour weeks building their base of knowledge and experience before going out into practice on their own, whether they are doctors or professors or lawyers or engineers. They have sought to perfect themselves. It is not clear how we could produce substantially more expertise than we already have. Yet our failures remain frequent. They persist despite remarkable individual ability. Here, then, is our situation at the start of the 21st century. We have accumulated stupendous know-how. We have put it in the hands of some of the most highly trained, highly skilled, and hard-working people in our society. And with it, they have indeed accomplished extraordinary things. Nonetheless, the know-how is often unmanageable. Avoidable failures are common and persistent, not to mention demoralizing and frustrating, across many fields, from medicine to finance, business to government. And the reason is increasingly evident. The volume and complexity of what we know has exceeded our individual ability to deliver its benefits correctly, safely, or reliably. Knowledge has both saved us and burdened us. That means we need a different strategy for overcoming failure, one that builds on experience and takes advantage of the knowledge people have, but somehow also makes up for our inevitable human inadequacies. And there is such a strategy, though it will seem almost ridiculous in its simplicity, maybe even crazy to those of us who have spent years carefully developing ever more advanced skills and technologies. It is a checklist. Chapter 1. The Problem of Extreme Complexity. Some time ago, I read a case report in the Annals of Thoracic Surgery. It was, in the dry prose of a medical journal article, the story of a nightmare. In a small Austrian town in the Alps, a mother and father had been out on a walk in the woods with their 3-year-old daughter. The parents lost sight of the girl for a moment, and that was all it took. She fell into an icy fish pond. The parents frantically jumped in after her. But she was lost beneath the surface for 30 minutes before they finally found her on the pond bottom. They pulled her to the surface and got her to the shore. Following instructions from an emergency response team reached on their cell phone, they began cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Rescue personnel arrived 8 minutes later and took the first recordings of the girl's condition. She was unresponsive. She had no blood pressure or pulse or sign of breathing. Her body temperature was just 66 degrees. Her pupils were dilated and unreactive to light, indicating cessation of brain function. She was gone. But the emergency technicians continued CPR anyway. A helicopter took her to the nearest hospital, where she was wheeled directly into an operating room, a member of the emergency crew straddling her on the gurney, pumping her chest. A surgical team got her onto a heart-lung bypass machine as rapidly as it could. The surgeon had to cut down through the skin of the child's right groin and sew one of the desk-size machine silicone rubber tubes into her femoral artery to take the blood out of her, then another into her femoral vein to send the blood back. A perfusionist turned the pump on, and as he adjusted the oxygen and temperature and flow through the system, the clear tubing turned maroon with her blood. Only then did they stop the girl's chest compressions. Between the transport time and the time it took to plug the machine into her, she had been lifeless for an hour and a half. By the two-hour mark, however, her body temperature had risen almost 10 degrees, and her heart began to beat. It was her first organ to come back. After 6 hours, the girl's core reached 98.6 degrees, normal body temperature. The team tried to shift her from the bypass machine to a mechanical ventilator, but the pond water and debris had damaged her lungs too severely for the oxygen pumped in through her breathing tube to reach her blood. So they switched her instead to an artificial lung system known as ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. To do this, the surgeons had to open her chest down the middle with a power saw and sew the lines to and from the portable ECMO unit directly into her aorta and her beating heart. The ECMO machine now took over. The surgeons removed the heart-lung bypass machine tubing. They repaired the vessels and closed her groin incision. The surgical team moved the girl into intensive care, with her chest still open and covered with sterile plastic foil. Through the day and night, the intensive care unit team worked on suctioning the water and debris from her lungs with a fiber optic bronchoscope. By the next day, her lungs had recovered sufficiently for the team to switch her from ECMO to a mechanical ventilator, which required taking her back to the operating room to unplug the tubing, repair the holes, and close her chest. Over the next 2 days, all the girl's organs recovered. Her liver, her kidneys, her intestines, everything except her brain. A CT scan showed global brain swelling, which is a sign of diffuse damage, but no actual dead zones. So the team escalated the care one step further. It drilled a hole into the girl's skull, threaded a probe into the brain to monitor the pressure, and kept that pressure tightly controlled through constant adjustments in her fluids and medications. For more than a week, she lay comatose. Then, slowly, she came back to life. First, her pupils started to react to light. Next, she began to breathe on her own. And, one day, she simply awoke. 2 weeks after her accident, she went home. Her right leg and left arm were partially paralyzed. Her speech was thick and slurry, but she underwent extensive outpatient therapy. By age 5, she had recovered her faculties completely. Physical and neurological examinations were normal. She was like any little girl again. What makes this recovery astounding isn't just the idea that someone could be brought back after 2 hours in a state that would once have been considered death. It's also the idea that a group of people in a random hospital could manage to pull off something so enormously complicated. Rescuing a drowning victim is nothing like it looks on television shows, where a few chest compressions and some mouth-to-mouth resuscitation always seem to bring someone with waterlogged lungs and a stilled heart, coughing and sputtering back to life. To save this one child, scores of people had to carry out thousands of steps correctly, placing the heart pump tubing into her without letting in air bubbles, maintaining the sterility of her lines, her open chest, the exposed fluid in her brain, keeping a temperamental battery of machines up and running. The degree of difficulty in any one of these steps is substantial. Then you must add the difficulties of orchestrating them in the right sequence, with nothing dropped, leaving some room for improvisation, but not too much. For every drowned and pulseless child rescued, there are scores more who don't make it, and not just because their bodies are too far gone. Machines break down. A team can't get moving fast enough. Someone fails to wash his hands, and an infection takes hold. Such cases don't get written up in the annals of thoracic surgery, but they are the norm, though people may not realize it. I think penicillin fooled us. Alexander Fleming's discovery in 1928 held out to mankind a beguiling vision of healthcare and how it would treat illness or injury in the future. A simple pill or injection would be capable of curing not just one condition, but perhaps many. Penicillin, after all, seemed to be effective against an astonishing variety of previously untreatable infectious diseases. So why not a similar cure-all for the different kinds of cancer? And why not something equally simple to melt away skin burns or to reverse cardiovascular disease and strokes? Medicine didn't turn out this way, though. After a century of incredible discovery, most diseases have proved to be both far more particular and difficult to treat. This is true even for the infections doctors once treated with penicillin. Not all bacterial strains were susceptible, and those that were soon developed resistance. Infections today require highly individualized treatment, sometimes with multiple therapies, based on a given strain's particular pattern of antibiotic susceptibility, the condition of the patient, and which organ systems are affected. The model of medicine in the modern age seems less and less like penicillin and more like what was required for the girl who nearly drowned. Medicine has become the art of managing extreme complexity, and a test of whether such complexity can, in fact, be humanly mastered. The 9th edition of the World Health Organization's International Classification of Diseases has grown to distinguish more than 13,000 different diseases, syndromes, and types of injury. More than 13,000 different ways, in other words, that the body can fail. And for nearly all of them, science has given us things we can do to help. If we cannot cure the disease, then we can usually reduce the harm and misery it causes. But for each condition, the steps are different, and they are almost never simple. Clinicians now have at their disposal some 6,000 drugs and 4,000 medical and surgical procedures, each with different requirements, risks, and considerations. It is a lot to get right. There is a community clinic in Boston's Kenmore Square, affiliated with my hospital. The word clinic makes the place sound tiny, but it's nothing of the sort. Founded in 1969 and now called Harvard Vanguard, it aimed to provide people with the full range of outpatient medical services they might need over the course of their lives. It has since tried to stick with that plan, but doing so hasn't been easy. To keep up with the explosive growth in medical capabilities, the clinic has had to build more than 20 facilities and employ some 600 doctors and 1,000 other health professionals covering 59 specialties, many of which did not exist when the clinic first opened. Walking the 50 steps from the 5th-floor elevator to the general surgery department, I pass offices for general internal medicine, endocrinology, genetics, hand surgery, laboratory testing, nephrology, ophthalmology, orthopedics, radiology scheduling, and urology. And that's just one hallway. To handle the complexity, we've split up the tasks among various specialties. But even divvied up, the work can become overwhelming. In the course of one day on general surgery call at the hospital, for instance, the labor floor asked me to see a 25-year-old woman with mounting right lower abdominal pain, fever, and nausea, which raised concern about appendicitis, but she was pregnant, so getting a CT scan to rule out the possibility posed a risk to the fetus. A gynecological oncologist paged me to the operating room about a woman with an ovarian mass that upon removal appeared to be a metastasis from pancreatic cancer. My colleague wanted me to examine her pancreas and decide whether to biopsy it. A physician at a nearby hospital phoned me to transfer a patient in intensive care with a large cancer that had grown to obstruct her kidneys and bowel and produce bleeding that they were having trouble controlling. Our internal medicine service called me to see a 61-year-old man with emphysema so severe he had been refused hip surgery because of insufficient lung reserves. Now he had a severe colon infection, an acute diverticulitis, that had worsened despite 3 days of antibiotics, and surgery seemed his only option. Another service asked for help with a 52-year-old man with diabetes, coronary artery disease, high blood pressure, chronic kidney failure, severe obesity, a stroke, and now a strangulating groin hernia. And an internist called about a young, otherwise healthy woman with a possible rectal abscess to be lanced. Confronted with cases of such variety and intricacy, in one day I'd had 6 patients with 6 completely different primary medical problems and a total of 26 different additional diagnoses, it's tempting to believe that no one else's job could be as complex as mine. But extreme complexity is the rule for almost everyone. I asked the people in Harvard Vanguard's medical records department if they would query the electronic system for how many different kinds of patient problems the average doctor there sees annually. The answer that came back flabbergasted me. Over the course of a year of office practice, which by definition excludes the patients seen in the hospital, physicians each evaluated an average of 250 different primary diseases and conditions. Their patients had more than 900 other active medical problems that had to be taken into account. The doctors each prescribed some 300 medications, ordered more than 100 different types of laboratory tests, and performed an average of 40 different kinds of office procedures, from vaccinations to setting fractures. Of all the specialists, the general internists had the most varied caseload. They managed an average of 371 different primary diagnoses, plus 1,010 other active medical problems. They prescribed 627 medications, and they did 36 different kinds of office procedures. Contemplating the extent of knowledge general internists had to grapple with made my brain ache. And this was just their office work. The information system did not capture the numerous issues doctors faced in their hospital patients. Even considering just the office work, though, the statistics still didn't catch all the diagnoses. One of the most common, it turned out, was other. On a hectic day, when you're running 2 hours behind and the people in the waiting room are getting irate, you may not take the time to record the precise diagnostic codes in the database. But even when you do have the time, you commonly find that the particular diseases your patients have do not actually exist in the computer system. The software used in most American electronic records has not managed to include all the diseases and conditions that have been discovered and distinguished from one another in recent years. I once saw a patient with a ganglioneuroblastoma, a rare type of tumor of the adrenal gland, and another with a nightmarish genetic condition called Lee-Fromeni syndrome, which causes inheritors to develop cancers in organs all over their bodies. Neither disease had yet made it into the pull-down menus. All I could record was, in so many words, other. Scientists continue to report important new genetic findings, subtypes of cancer and other diagnoses, not to mention treatments, almost weekly. The complexity is increasing so fast, even the computers cannot keep up. But it's not only the breadth and quantity of knowledge that has made medicine complicated. It is also the execution, the practical matter of what knowledge requires clinicians to do. The hospital is where you see just how formidable the task can be. A prime example is the place the girl who nearly drowned spent most of her recovery, the intensive care unit. It's an opaque term, intensive care. Specialists in the field prefer to call what they do critical care, but that still doesn't exactly clarify matters. The non-medical term life support gets us closer. The damage that the human body can survive these days is as awesome as it is horrible. Crushing, burning, bombing, a burst aorta, a ruptured colon, a massive heart attack, rampaging infection. These maladies were once uniformly fatal. Now survival is commonplace. And a substantial part of the credit goes to the abilities intensive care units have developed to take artificial control of failing bodies. Typically, this requires a panoply of technology. A mechanical ventilator and perhaps a tracheostomy tube if the lungs have failed. An aortic balloon pump if the heart has given out. A dialysis machine if the kidneys don't work. If you are unconscious and can't eat, silicone tubing can be surgically inserted into your stomach or intestines for formula feeding. If your intestines are too damaged, solutions of amino acids, fatty acids, and glucose can be infused directly into your bloodstream. On any given day in the United States alone, some 90,000 people are admitted to intensive care. Over a year, an estimated 5 million Americans will be. And over a normal lifetime, nearly all of us will come to know the glassed bay of an ICU from the inside. Wide swaths of medicine now depend on the life support systems that ICUs provide. Care for premature infants, for victims of trauma, strokes, and heart attacks, for patients who have had surgery on their brains, hearts, lungs, or major blood vessels. Critical care has become an increasingly large portion of what hospitals do. 50 years ago, ICUs barely existed. Now, to take a recent random day in my hospital, 155 of our almost 700 patients are in intensive care. The average stay of an ICU patient is 4 days, and the survival rate is 86%. Going into an ICU, being put on a mechanical ventilator, having tubes and wires run into and out of you, is not a sentence of death. But the days will be the most precarious of your life. 15 years ago, Israeli scientists published a study in which engineers observed patient care in ICUs for 24-hour stretches. They found that the average patient required 178 individual actions per day, ranging from administering a drug to suctioning the lungs, and every one of them posed risks. Remarkably, the nurses and doctors were observed to make an error in just 1% of these actions, but that still amounted to an average of 2 errors a day with every patient. Intensive care succeeds only when we hold the odds of doing harm low enough for the odds of doing good to prevail. This is hard. There are dangers simply in lying unconscious in bed for a few days. Muscles atrophy. Bones lose mass. Pressure ulcers form. Veins begin to clot. You have to stretch and exercise patients' flaccid limbs daily to avoid contractures. You have to give subcutaneous injections of blood thinners at least twice a day. Turn patients in bed every few hours. Bathe them and change their sheets without knocking out a tube or a line. Brush their teeth twice a day to avoid pneumonia from bacterial buildup in their mouths. Add a ventilator, dialysis, and the care of open wounds, and the difficulties only accumulate. The story of one of my patients makes the point. Anthony DiFilippo was a 48-year-old limousine driver from Everett, Massachusetts, who started to hemorrhage at a community hospital during surgery for a hernia and gallstones. The surgeon was finally able to stop the bleeding, but DiFilippo's liver was severely damaged, and over the next few days he became too sick for the hospital's facilities. I accepted him for transfer in order to stabilize him and figure out what to do. When he arrived in our ICU at 1:30 a.m. on a Sunday, His ragged black hair was plastered to his sweaty forehead. His body was shaking, and his heart was racing at 114 beats a minute. He was delirious from fever, shock, and low oxygen levels. "I need to get out," he cried. "I need to get out." He clawed at his gown, his oxygen mask, the dressings covering his abdominal wound. "Tony, it's all right," a nurse said to him. "We're going to help you. You're in a hospital." He shoved her out of the way, he was a big man, and tried to swing his legs out of the bed. We turned up his oxygen flow, put his wrists in cloth restraints, and tried to reason with him. He eventually tired out and let us draw blood and give him antibiotics. The laboratory results came back showing liver failure and a steeply elevated white blood cell count, indicating infection. It soon became evident from his empty urine bag that his kidneys had failed too. In the next few hours, his blood pressure fell, his breathing worsened, and he drifted from agitation to near unconsciousness. Each of his organ systems, including his brain, was shutting down. I called his sister, his next of kin, and told her the situation. "Do everything you can," she said. So we did. We gave him a syringe full of anesthetic, and a resident slid a breathing tube into his throat. Another resident lined him up. She inserted a thin 2-inch-long needle and catheter through his upturned right wrist and into his radial artery, then sewed the line to his skin with a silk suture. Next, she put in a central line, a 12-inch catheter pushed into the jugular vein in his left neck. After she sewed that in place, and an X-ray showed its tip floating just where it was supposed to, inside his vena cava at the entrance to his heart, she put a third, slightly thicker line for dialysis through his right upper chest and into the subclavian vein, deep under the collarbone. We hooked a breathing tube up to a hose from a ventilator and set it to give him 14 forced breaths of 100% oxygen every minute. We dialed the ventilator pressures and gas flow up and down, like engineers at a control panel, until we got the blood levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide where we wanted them. The arterial line gave us continual arterial blood pressure measurements, and we tweaked his medications to get the pressures we liked. We regulated his intravenous fluids according to venous pressure measurements from his jugular line. We plugged his subclavian line into tubing from a dialysis machine, and every few minutes his entire blood volume washed through this artificial kidney and back into his body. A little adjustment here and there, and we could alter the levels of potassium and bicarbonate and salt as well. He was, we like to imagine, a simple machine in our hands. But he wasn't, of course. It was as if we had gained a steering wheel and a few gauges and controls, but on a runaway 18-wheeler hurtling down a mountain. Keeping that patient's blood pressure normal required gallons of intravenous fluid and a pharmacy shelf of drugs. He was on near-maximal ventilator support. His temperature climbed to 104 degrees. Less than 5% of patients with DeFilippo's degree of organ failure make it home. A single misstep could easily erase those slender chances. For 10 days, though, we made progress. DeFilippo's chief problem had been liver damage from his prior operation. The main duct from his liver was severed and was leaking bile, which is caustic. It digests the fat in one's diet and was essentially eating him alive from the inside. He had become too sick to survive an operation to repair the leak. So once we had stabilized him, we tried a temporary solution. We had radiologists place a plastic drain, using X-ray guidance, through his abdominal wall and into the severed duct in order to draw out the leaking bile. They found so much that they had to place 3 drains, one inside the duct and 2 around it. But as the bile drained out, his fever subsided. His need for oxygen and fluids diminished, and his blood pressure returned to normal. He was beginning to mend. Then, on the 11th day, just as we were getting ready to take him off the mechanical ventilator, he developed high spiking fevers. His blood pressure sank, and his blood oxygen levels plummeted again. His skin became clammy. He got shaking chills. We couldn't understand what had happened. He seemed to have developed an infection, but our X-rays and CT scans failed to turn up a source. Even after we put him on 4 antibiotics, he continued to spike fevers. During one fever, his heart went into fibrillation. A code blue was called. A dozen nurses and doctors raced to his bedside, slapped electric paddles onto his chest, and shocked him. His heart responded and went back into rhythm. It took 2 more days for us to figure out what had gone wrong. We considered the possibility that one of his lines had become infected, so we put in new lines and sent the old ones to the lab for culturing. 48 hours later, the results returned. All the lines were infected. The infection had probably started in one line, which perhaps was contaminated during insertion, and spread through DeFilippo's bloodstream to the others. Then they all began spilling bacteria into him, producing the fevers and steep decline. This is the reality of intensive care. At any point, we are as apt to harm as we are to heal. Line infections are so common that they are considered a routine complication. ICUs put 5 million lines into patients each year, and national statistics show that after 10 days, 4% of those lines become infected. Line infections occur in 80,000 people a year in the United States and are fatal between 5 and 28% of the time, depending on how sick one is at the start. Those who survive line infections spend, on average, a week longer in intensive care. And this is just one of many risks. After 10 days with a urinary catheter, 4% of American ICU patients develop a bladder infection. After 10 days on a ventilator, 6% develop bacterial pneumonia, resulting in death 40 to 45% of the time. All in all, about half of ICU patients end up experiencing a serious complication, and once that occurs, the chances of survival drop sharply. It was another week before DeFilippo recovered sufficiently from his infections to come off the ventilator, and 2 months before he left the hospital. Weak and debilitated, he lost his limousine business and his home, and he had to move in with his sister. The tube draining bile still dangled from his abdomen. When he was stronger, I was going to have to do surgery to reconstruct the main bile duct from his liver.